Welcome, everyone, to episode 73 of Underserved. Joining me today is Shad Shudi, Director of Agile Delivery at Liberty Mutual Insurance. Let's get started.
Welcome to this week's edition of Underserved, the podcast for the rest of the tech industry, where we focus on stories of tech industry leaders, their insights, and their lessons learned. And now, your host, Andrew Jalina.
Shad, thank you so much for joining us today on Underserved.
Thanks, Andrew. I appreciate it. Glad to be here.
So tell us way back when, like, what was one of your first memories of thinking about being involved with technology?
The first thing that comes to mind is my mom had sent me a bunch of stuff that she had been saving from when I was in school. And my junior year in high school, we did statewide assessments. And it used to be they asked you a series of survey type questions. And it was, you know, are you interested in technology and all this stuff? Ironically, when she sent it to me, I was reading my answers and it says Shad has no interest in computers. Shad doesn't want to work with technology. And so, you know, that's kind of the first thing I can think of when it comes back to it. The irony is a year later, I graduated high school, joined the Navy as an electronics technician. That didn't last very long.
Yeah, your dad was an electrician, right?
Yep, for 32 years, he worked for a chemical plant as an instrumentation and operations guy, managing all the automated systems.
Did you ever wonder, like, I wonder if I could be an electrician?
Yeah, I actually applied through the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers when I was 20. But back then, it was if you got into the union, you ended up going wherever there was construction, and you had like a couple day notice. They called me and said, hey, can you be in Gillette, Wyoming on Monday? And this was like a Thursday. There was no way I could do it. I just wasn't financially able to go up there and move myself. So I turned it down and decided to go back to school.
You said you spent some time in the armed forces. What was that like?
So I went into the Navy as an electronics tech. I joined during Desert Storm 1. You know, the military was a great thing. It helped me mature a lot faster. You learn a lot of things that your mom and dad did for you that you did not realize they did for you. Laundry is the first thing that comes to mind. Don't think I had ever done laundry, and all of a sudden I had to figure it out real quick. The military was great, probably one of the better spur of the moment decisions I ever made. It gave me the foundation so I could build from there to where I'm at now today.
And so you got offered early discharge. Do you start at like a local community college?
Yeah. So I came home and started out at a local community college. Originally thought I was going to do engineering, and then I went into criminal justice. Got my associates and then transferred to through Park University on the Air Force Base here in Cheyenne, Wyoming. And that's where I finished my bachelor's degree in administration of criminal justice.
Now, you had thought about doing some software work, but a professor of Pascal had some instructive words, right?
Yeah. So when I was going into the engineering, it was going to be computer engineering. And I took the very first programming class, the intro to computer science that they have you in was Pascal. You know, I got through it. I got a C out of the class, but I was talking with a professor about midway through it. We were talking about the struggles I had. And he's like, look, you have to be able to think in the abstract. You're great. If I tell you, go write this and do this, and it should do that, you can write that. But if I tell you, here's a problem, go solve it with computer language, I struggled with that part of it. You know, he kind of nudged me that I could probably be an okay engineer, but I was never going to be great. And so I decided to switch majors in my second year.
You graduate, but your first job's actually working with Jeldwin, the window company. Why was that noteworthy? And how did you run into your coworkers later on in your career?
Yeah, I was the night shift manager of the glass department. In Jeldwin, we made vinyl windows. I had a staff of 20-some individuals. Most of my staff had some level of criminal record. We joked with them and all that. They knew my degree was in criminal justice. Well, then I got an offer and I applied through the sheriff's department and got hired at the sheriff's department. Within my first year, several of the individuals that I had managed had come into jail. And then when I went to patrol, I ended up arresting a couple of the guys for different individual crimes that they would commit. And, you know, they thought they knew me and they were going to get off easy. And that's just not how I worked.
Yeah, it said during the pre-call that out of 26 guys in the glass department, 14 with criminal records, you arrested 5 of them.
Yeah, that sounds exactly right. The 5 I arrested, but there were at least 10 that came through the jail when I was working just in the jail.
Cheyenne's not a huge town, right? You're likely to run into folks.
Yeah, absolutely. So even now, I think in the total county, there's a little over 85,000 people. Back then, it was, you know, 40 to 50,000 people. And we were the largest city in the state of Wyoming. So we're pretty sparsely populated as general. But if you met somebody, you're probably going to run into them at least once, if not numerous times after that.
And so at the sheriff's department, you mentioned working in the jail. What was that like?
Yeah, that was an eye-opening experience. You realize how good you have it sometimes and how good your parents were. It makes you appreciate that. I remember after I finished my trainee period and I was on my own, went to my parents' house and I thanked my mom for being such a good parent because I never ended up in jail. You experience, I called it babysitting the worst toddlers you'll ever meet, and they're adults and they think everybody owes them something. So it was pretty rough. I had fun though. You had to be able to enjoy it. My squad was great. I loved my sergeant. We had a pretty good team going.
I remember when I was leaving for my freshman year of college, my dad said, I'll see you in a year and bet you'll appreciate me a lot more when you come back. And I certainly did.
Absolutely. Yes.
You mentioned that you also saw some downsides of the social system. You had a story about that?
You spend a lot of your time with individuals that are there in the worst possible moment of their life, whether it be them as a victim or as a perpetrator. And so you end up seeing a lot of rough stuff. One of the stories that I love to tell people that sticks with me the most, I had gotten a call to a teenage girl who was attempting to commit suicide. She was living with her grandparents. When I got there, she had locked herself in a bathroom, and I had a female deputy with me, and we kind of broke in, and she had cut her wrist, and we took her to the hospital. You know, ambulance came and all that stuff, and I sat and I just started talking with her, kind of getting to know her and listening to her story and asking her what was going on in her life that led up to it, and we kind of developed a little bit of a bond. She is one of the only people I ever gave my personal cell phone number to, and I shared with her, and we kept in contact for quite a while. Just before I left, her grandparents had reached out to me, and she had gone missing again. And so we started asking for friends around. She had gotten involved with a much older gentleman who was in the Air Force. At this time, she was 16, getting ready to turn 17. So we've got his car. Highway Patrol found him. They got her out of the car and Maid told him to follow them back. They brought him back to Cheyenne. I had a nice discussion with him where I informed him that I could become the worst thing that ever happened to him, or he could never see me again, but the choice was his. He had to leave her alone, never contact her. If she calls, don't answer. And then I talked with her again, and you know, we kind of talked a little bit, and she was struggling with her mom had abandoned her. And so that was a lot of things that was going on in her life. I left law enforcement later that year, and almost 2 years later, I get a call and a card, an invite to a graduation. And it was this young lady was graduating high school. She called and asked me if I would please attend. And so I said, sure. So I attended her graduation and then the after party. And we talked and she told me she had got accepted to college and she was going to school. And that, you know, I was the only reason that she was actually graduating high school. I was the only reason that she was actually going to college. I never gave up on her. I never abandoned her. And I invested my time and whenever she called. Fast forward about 11 years later, I get a Christmas card and she had gotten married, had kids, was settled down, and she just wanted to say thank you again. And those are the kind of things that I remember and I'm very proud of, because you got to see a lot of the hardship of things. I saw a lot of child abuse cases, and the only homicide that occurred in Cheyenne in the 1 year was one of my cases. But one brother killed another brother, and you know, that's always a hard thing to see. And I've got brothers and I just couldn't imagine it. So yeah, law enforcement, it was great. I'll never talk bad about it, but it was very trying on the soul and on the person. But it teaches you a lot of things. Patience, dedication, kind of stick-to-itiveness, if you will. There was definitely bonuses to going down that career path first.
I love hearing that story. Like, there's a lot of good police officers who are really in it to serve the community and to make, you know, where they live a better place, one person at a time. There's a lot of press about when things go the other way. So it's great to hear an uplifting story like that.
Absolutely. I see all the stuff that's going on in, you know, our society today. And I question if I could even be a law enforcement now, because it's not about what that police officer or sheriff's deputy is doing for their community. It's the one time that they make a mistake, and we're all human. We are going to make mistakes. It's the degree of that mistake. You know, I totally agree that there has to be accountability. There just can't be persecution without facts.
You are listening to the Underserved Podcast. Underserved is produced by Syrinx, the developer-founded, developer-run software consulting company. For more information, visit syrinx.com. That's syrinx.com.
So the television show Yellowstone is super popular right now with John Dutton, who's a livestock officer. You know, you weren't in Montana, but darn close by. Is it like that out there? Like, is cattle rustling or horse rustling a thing?
Not as prevalent as it used to be, but one irony of it is our livestock officers are state officers. They actually have more authority than most law enforcement. In fact, I think they have more than anybody else. They can go across counties, across cities. They don't have to worry about municipalities. They enforce all state laws, not just the livestock laws. Plus, when it comes to the livestock, they get a little bit more leeway, not having to have warrants and those type of things, especially if it's related to cattle rustling or horse theft. And you do still see some of that, not as common, and they've gotten a little smarter about how they do it, but so have the livestock officers. The one thing here in Wyoming is usually when they get in and get hired as a livestock officer, they don't leave. It's a rare time that there's an opening in that office. So it's a few people that get it. They stick to it for as long as they possibly can.
Isn't there a penalty, like there's more time in prison for horse theft than like a lot of drug possession?
Absolutely. So if you're found guilty of conviction of horse rustling, carries a higher minimum sentence than possession of Schedule I narcotic.
Wow.
Under a certain weight. Now, of course, if you've got, you know, 7-8 kilos, you're going to be considered a trafficker. But yeah, our legislators are pretty much farmers and ranchers. They do not take kindly to people taking their animals.
Oh, it sounds like the story was written with a grain of truth from the real world.
Absolutely.
So there's kind of a downside to law enforcement. You are spending a lot of time with some folks that are pretty tough. What made you think I might want to move on?
I caught a series of child abuse cases, better part of about 4.5 months. And that really weighs on a person, you know, and it's also something you don't want to bring home and share with your family. So you don't often talk about it. And my wife sat me down one day when I was off and she's like, I don't know how long we could do this. You don't talk to me. You're isolated. You got to do something. And so we talked about it. I told her, I said, look, okay, here's my login credentials to the state website. You see jobs that you think I might qualify for or fit into, apply me for it. I got an interview with the Wyoming Department of Education as a IT project manager.
What was that interview like?
It was interesting. So it was a Tuesday, and so I was actually working day shift. They wanted me to come in at 3 o'clock. So I called back and I said, yeah, I can absolutely do this, but I will be in full uniform and I'll be taking my lunch break. So I'll have my radio and all that stuff. I'll just turn it off. But, you know, that's the only way I can make this work. And they're like, oh, sure, no problem. So I showed up, went to the interview, and it was a very good interview. And they offered me the job, and my first day there, they kind of do the introduction and a little lunch to introduce you. And our director was in the lunch and she's sitting down. We were just kind of talking. She goes, I have to ask you, when you came in for the interview, how many weapons did you have on you? I kind of started chuckling and I was like, well, I mean, are you talking just firearms or just weapons? She's like, any weapons. Well, I had my duty weapon and I had my backup weapon and I had my baton and my taser and my pepper spray and pocket knife and my boot knife. And, you know, and she's like, so we kind of had to hire you, didn't we? And everybody started laughing and it was a good joke. I was like, well, you know, it would have been in your best interest. So I guess you did the right thing.
Now, you went out with a bang. Didn't you win the DUI award for law enforcement your last year?
Yep. I left the sheriff's department in January, and in February or March, the governor announces the DUI awards for the prior year. And it was me and one other deputy that were recognized with the highest DUI arrests. Governor Silver Award is what it's called. So I had more than 50 DUI arrests. And the irony of it is I only worked the night shift for less than half a year. I think it was only like 3.5 months total that I worked the night shift. I was a very keen eye for DUIs. I could pick them out pretty quickly and get the justification to make the stop and go from there.
So you hang up the breathalyzer and the boot knife and you go to work for the Wyoming Department of Education. What's that like?
It was a drastically different work environment than what I had just left from. As a sheriff's deputy, 5 years with the department, bachelor's degree, master's degree, and my first year hired as a project manager for the Wyoming Department of Education, working Monday through Friday, 8 hours a day, nobody yelling at me, nothing like that. I made $20,000 a year more than I made as a sheriff's deputy. That was a kind of a little shock to me. But I've done many different things in my life. And from all of them, I tried to learn a lesson that is applicable across the board. In law enforcement, it was a little bit of organization. It was a little bit of negotiation and communication. And so I came into the Department of Education working as what was called the WISE. We were working with the 48 school districts and using schools interoperability framework, SIF technology, to create a single source of truth called the student information system that communicated to lunch systems, transportation systems, library systems through different tools called SIF agents. So an agent would sit at school information system and listen or communicate out. A new student came in, they enrolled the student, they entered the information, they would send that student's information, their first name, last name, the grade, the teacher, to the lunch system, to the library system, to the transportation system. The transportation system would then automatically route that student. What buses would they be authorized to ride on and those type of things. Wyoming was one of the first states to do a full SIF operation. We used it at the state level because it would collect the data from the source system through a standard pattern so that we could generate the No Child Left Behind and federal reporting requirements. At the time, there was a whole series of reports that had just been added to the states that there was a commonality across all states on what had to be reported, whether it was, you know, Title I students and special ed and free and reduced lunch, all the different kinds of stuff that had to be reported. And SIF allowed us to standardize it. So our school districts could have whatever information system they wanted. And SIF was vendor agnostic, so we could set an agent out there and be able to get the data in exact same format that we wanted. We presented numerous times at the National Center for Educational Statistics annual conference. It really got me going into project management at that level and working with the vendors and the developers and the database administrators and all those guys. It really got me excited for IT again.
Now, did you work with some outside vendors there as well?
Yep. At the state, we had hired a couple of vendors, Choice Solutions and ESP out of Texas, and then EduStructures out of Salt Lake were our three major vendors. Choice Solutions was our primary vendor. I created a very good relationship with those guys. When I decided it was time for me to broaden my horizons and expand a little bit farther into the IT world in project management and software development, I reached out to the president of the company at Choice Solutions and told him I was starting to look and that I was going to be leaving the Department of Education. And he, on the spot, offered me a position, matched the salary. I threw a huge number that I thought was ridiculous out there, and he said, okay. And it was a great decision. I went to work for Choice Solutions. I didn't work with Wyoming anymore because they wanted a clean break, but we had other project managers that came in and helped Wyoming out. But I ended up working with numerous states. Yeah, I had a pretty good gamut across the board. I also worked with the U.S. Department of Education on the National Education Data Model. We used the data model based off of part of it off of Common Core and part of it off of standardized curriculum structures, but it was great. I got to really get deep into software development, and it's where I started experimenting with agile software development, kind of getting my feet wet with Scrum and Kanban and those type of things. And I found I had a great passion for it. And to me, it was a very exciting time. Agile was starting to get some notice, but it wasn't huge. A lot of people were still doing waterfall. PMPs were still the main certification that you had to get. So getting in early and becoming familiar with Agile was awesome.
I am altering the scope of the project. Pray I don't alter it any further.
Excellent. Let the scope creep flow. Keep adding features.
To deploy the release,
deliver first. You must.
I find your lack of faith in change management disturbing.
Missing your deadline is the path to the dark side.
If you or someone you know manages software development projects, we can help. Call the offices of Syrinx Consulting. Syrinx provides software consultants who hit the ground running to help you deliver right away. Our toll-free number is 888-579-7469, option 1. Or you can live chat with Berg at Syrinx.com. That's Syrinx.com.
Syrinx is not a law office, and this is not legal advice. Offer valid only in the United States. Hablamos español, pero solo un poco y no tener ni pies ni cabeza. Saludos.
Now, Choice Solutions was out of Marlboro. Were you still living in Wyoming?
Yep. So I was living in Wyoming, and Marlboro, Mass. Is where the Choice Solutions office was. And then I would travel quite a bit, went to go see all of our states that I was the customer rep for and the project manager for. So I would work with our customers, and then the nighttime, I would work with our development teams in Hyderabad, India, which is Choice Solutions was a partnership between two brothers, one who lived here in the U.S. and one who lived in Hyderabad. And here in the U.S., they had the project managers and the architects. And in Hyderabad, we had the engineers and the QA testers. And so, I worked all day with my customers. And then at night, I would spend about 5 hours working with the development team. It was very early in it. We were a small company, so I was acting as both PO and Scrum Master. And you did a little bit of everything. It was a little bit of a trial by fire, but I stayed busy. And I'm a very an impatient person. I do not like to sit around very much. The busier I am, the better I can be. And working 16 or 18 hours a day, that fit my personality very well. I don't recommend that for everybody, but that's for me. I was excited and passionate about what I did and still am.
Now, that company eventually gets acquired, right?
Yeah, we got bought by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, which is the largest school publishing textbook company in the world. We were bought by them. And part of the deal, I was under the impression of I was going to be made a director and be able to move up in the level hierarchy. And I was so ingrained with the customers, it was hard for them to pull me out of working with customers and handling those individual contracts. So I gave them a little over a year, and then I started looking. That's when I spent a little time working for you as a contractor working with Cengage, which was very similar to Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, content publisher and online education applications. And so it was a great experience. It helped me see a whole nother light of it. Glad I got that startup type experience with Choice Solutions, and I went to a major corporation. Then I spent a little time as a contractor, and all of those things help build that repertoire of skills that people look for when you're, in the job market. We know the job market in IT is not going away, and everything's technology.
But you're living up in New Hampshire, commuting down to Boston. That's got to be a grind.
Yeah. Coming from Wyoming, where there is no traffic. I mean, they used to joke that the only traffic jam was in July when they brought the cattle in for the rodeo. So I started looking at other options and seeing if there were any options available in New Hampshire. And that's when the position opened up with Liberty Mutual as a Scrum Master. I applied for it and it just couldn't have worked out any better. The place I was actually living at in Hampton Falls was 3.5 minutes from the office that I was going to be working at. So it was almost like commuting back here in Cheyenne. I didn't have any traffic to deal with. And I went to work for Liberty Mutual in their GRM, which is their global retail market, US claims department. So we handled all claims for all Liberty and Safeco through our business unit.
Now, most insurance companies tend to be quite wagile. Was it like that when you got there?
When I first came in, there was few pockets that were starting to go agile. And the company was starting to talk about it and learn about it, especially on the business side, which is if you can't get your business partners buy-in, agile usually struggles. That's just the nature of it. And so it was starting to get, the first couple of years were very agile. And then Liberty went through what they called CCAD, Customer-Centric Agile Development. And so we moved all of our business units to a standardized foundation of agile, if you will. We moved from our prior ticketing system to Jira and Atlassian and using industry standard with it. And we started moving everybody towards agile. And it was a very exciting time. When I was first hired there, the job's titles were project managers. And they got rid of that job family and they created a job family called Scrum Masters, and business analysts were technically product owners. They got rid of the business analysts and created product owners. So people had to reapply for their job, which made everybody very nervous, as you can imagine. They did a really good job, not perfect, but they did a really pretty good job of it. Coming out of that, I was actually promoted to a senior Scrum Master, which is of the individual contributors. That's the highest level you can get before you come into management, which was great for me. Senior Scrum Masters were expected to kind of pick up a heavier load than everybody else. I was running 6 or 7 teams, one of the teams being the leadership team, which was the hardest team to manage. It was a very exciting time. And now I would say that as a general rule, we are much more agile than Wagile. Yes, we still have some leftovers. Our budgeting is done annually, where if we were really going to be doing agile, you would be budgeting for, I can afford X number of people on this team or X teams, and whatever they deliver is delivering. But there's some accountability, and the insurance industry has a lot of regulation. So we've got to make sure that we're dotting the I's and crossing the T's. So the budgeting is still pretty stagnant, but we're working on it and we're trying to get better at it.
Now, one day your boss pulls you into a room and it's like, so we have this thing called Claims One. What happens after that?
When I first started there, they had what was called flagship projects. And I was brought in to do a flagship project, which was the Guidewire 8 upgrade. And Guidewire is the main claim system. It's our monolithic backbone of our claims in all of US. We finished that, and then I did the auto property damage, and I was kind of not sure where I was going to go. And my boss pulled me into a room, and they're like, look, we've got claims one, and we think this is an 18 roll, and I know you're 17, but we think you can handle it, do it. And I was like, of course, you know, it's a challenge. I'll jump onto it. So the goal behind claims one, and Liberty was investing heavily in creating a single policy system and a single claim system for all of Liberty and Safeco, but they were using a different system, and all the acquisitions that Liberty had had over the years, there was a lot of disparate systems. So we were trying to centralize and commonize the way we handle claims and processing. Claims one originally was supposed to be a stopgap, and it was essentially to be able to make it do the mapping and the coding so that we could then be able to process a claim from Safeco in Guidewire. It was a part of a much larger and much more expensive program that was called integration. And so we got the first year into it, and we were doing good. We never missed a deadline. We released every month into production for 42 total months. In the middle of that, they decided that the integration program wasn't seeing the benefits and the results that they wanted. So they canceled everything except for claims one. You know, no pressure. Now it's all on us to make it work. But I had an amazing team that I was working with. I cannot speak highly enough about my product owners and my engineers. They stepped up, and we nailed it. We delivered on time every release across the country. We did it in staged releases by regions. And so we did all of the auto and all of the home. Gotta say, these guys did a phenomenal job. And as a result, that team and myself, we won the IT Excellence Award, which is the highest award a team can get. It was great. Nice to get the recognition, and nice for my team to be identified as, you know, outstanding in their field.
So you do that in 2019. What's 2020 like?
So we finished that in 2019, and then there was an open position for the Director of Agile Delivery. And I applied in January of 2020. So I interview, we go through that whole process. I get hired, and I start the middle of April. Well, the last week of March, we had went 100% remote because of COVID and the pandemic and that. And everybody's like, oh, yeah, we'll start traveling by June. And so it was okay. So I started with this. And my first week was the first non-in-person PI planning for the Global Digital Ecosystem, which is the program that I work on. And that program is 17 countries in 14 time zones, where prior, they were going, you know, every couple of weeks, they would go to either Ireland or Spain and they would meet. And then every six sprints, 12 weeks, they would do a PI planning in person in a conference room with easels and sticky notes. And now here I am, the brand new guy in charge of the Agile. And they're like, we need a virtual PI planning. It was a good learning experience, I will say. So in 2020, we had our first PI planning. We used Lucid charts to coordinate the work, and that became a bit of an eye chart that was almost impossible to read. In 2020, we went through three different systems, trying to figure out the best way. 2021, we went through two, and we finally have settled on a good program, but we have done nothing but virtual PI plannings. And at that time, we were only in the Western European market. We've now expanded into the Asia multi-country market, and we've already gone live in Vietnam and getting ready to go live in Thailand. Next hurdle will be for us to go into our Andes market, which is our South and Central America countries. So I'm hoping eventually I'll get to do that travel that they promised me when they interviewed me. But so far, the only traveling I've done is moving from New Hampshire back to Wyoming.
So with five different systems trying out PI planning, which one did you land on that you finally like?
So we are actually using Jira Portfolio. We use initiatives to identify the business functionality that's being delivered. And then those initiatives are linked to epics, and those epics to the stories. And then we use Team Name to identify our individual teams. And so we can look at an individual team, their next six sprints, and see the work that they have planned out. And they made a lot of improvements. The first time I used Jira Portfolio, it was, let me just say, it was the most difficult thing I think I'd ever tried to figure out. And I consider myself a pretty good guy with software and technology, and I could not make the original first versions of Portfolio work. And then Atlassian, they did a couple really good things with it. It's really meeting our needs now. We're a large program over multiple countries, and as I mentioned, with hundreds of people that work on it. and we're able to have a common visual for everybody. So yeah, Jira has turned out to be a little bit of a blessing for us.
I imagine with each implementation, they keep raising the bar and shortening the timeline. How does that look?
Yes. In fact, our program, we had a roadmap for 2022 that we were planning on delivering certain functions within the Western European market to include home, workman's comp, commercial vehicles, and all that. Well, the Western European market actually responded to an RFP issued by a bank in Spain called Bankinter, and we won, which was surprising. It's the first time we had tried to get into it. And a big component of us winning was the global digital ecosystem that we've developed, which is, you know, the whole concept behind our system is you have a central core application that you can pick up and move to any country you want, and it will still operate the same way. The only thing you have to change are languages and localization. It was a tech bet in 2018 and 2019. That tech bet has turned into a full funded program. So we've gone crazy. But yeah, we won Bankinter. That was announced last month. Just to give you an idea, it took a little over a year and a half to get Ireland auto direct, the first release. Then we did Spain in 6 months, and then we did Portugal in about 3 months after that. And then it took about 8 months to do Vietnam, and we're hoping Thailand will be just a few months. But now we've got the Bankinter integration, and they want us to get it done, at least the MVP and main functionality, by December 1st. Like we like to say, the only constant in GDE is that we're going to have more work than time, and that's a good thing to have.
So when you finally pry yourself away from the keyboard, what do you do for fun?
My brothers like to call me a jack of all trades, a master of none. I spend a lot of time riding my motorcycle. Love the feel of being out on the open road, the wind in your hair, and seeing new things and experiencing new stuff. The one thing I don't get out of IT that I have always been driven to is actually the physical building of something. You know, when I moved back here, I converted my garage into a shop. I don't think there's been a vehicle parked in it since I bought the house. But I love to go out to my garage, and this winter I built a couple trailers, and I do woodworking, anything I can do. I built a shelf that has a magnetic opening and the bottom drops out, and so it's like a secret shelf. Saw it on YouTube, and it's like, oh, I could do that. So yeah, I spend a lot of time building stuff. I'm a huge dog lover, so I do volunteer some time at a local animal shelter. I have two rescues. I spoil them rotten, but you know, they're pretty good little girls, and we have a good time. That's kind of what I do. My weekends are, like I said, I don't like to sit around, so I'm always doing something.
What kind of motorcycle are you putting around on?
So I just bought a 2021 Indian Challenger. I traded in my Indian Chieftain, one of the only models the Indian has where it's a frame-mounted fairing instead of fork-mounted, which buffets the wind so much more on the highway. And if you know anything about Wyoming, we are windy. Mm-hmm. So anything that buffets the wind is a bonus.
Yep. I am a fellow Indian motorcycle owner. I have a 2000 Chief, which in 2000, with my buddy Art, we took a cross-country motorcycle trip, including just going through the little tiny corner of Wyoming. And it was quite windy. I remember that.
Yeah, my goal is to, I'd love to ride my motorcycle in all 48 states. I've been to all 48 states, but not on a motorcycle. And so that would be my goal. Probably have to wait till I retire.
That's going to be a long ride, but a good goal.
Absolutely.
So Shad, thank you so much for joining us and sharing your experiences with the listeners of Underserved.
Thanks, Andrew. I appreciate you having me.
And we'll talk to everyone soon on the next episode of Underserved.
Thank you for listening to the Underserved podcast. For more information on the topics discussed and for show notes, visit the show website, underserved.fm. And please be sure to rate, like, and subscribe to Underserved on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.